Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the official episode 105 of the Everything Coworking Podcast. This is Jamie Russo. For those of you that are new to the show, I own a coworking space in Palo Alto, California. I am the executive director of the Global Workspace Association, and through my Everything Coworking brand, I use my broad industry experience and exposure to help people like you start and run co-working spaces that meet their personal and financial goals. Speaking of which, I've been a little bit off the interview bandwagon as I get this cohort of the co-working startup school up and running, and it has been a fantastic experience. We have such a good group of students, and some of them are extremely dedicated and are jumping on the modules as soon as they come out, and I'm getting really helpful feedback and great interaction in our Slack group. I'm hoping to relaunch in July. I'm taking feedback, making some updates as required, and just kind of making sure everything is running smoothly before opening it back up again. So stay tuned. A couple of events coming up. You know, I wear my Global Workspace Association hat. We are hosting a one-day Co-working Council Series workshop in New York at the Players Club on May 30th. And Kevin Whalen, who has been on the podcast, I did not double check his episode number before I hopped on. It was in the last 10 or so, I would say. He is a marketing expert focused on helping co-working space owners run a great marketing portion of their business to attract customers and get them through the sales funnel. And he is doing a workshop for us on the anatomy of the perfect co-working website. So we are super excited to host him. If you're interested in the event, check out our website. Certainly send me an email if you can't find the details, jamie@globalworkspace.org. And that event is in Manhattan on May 30th. And then we have our annual conference coming up September 18th through the 20th. We are just finalizing the conference website, so tickets will go on sale in the next couple of weeks. But put that date in your calendar. We have some fantastic workshops lined up, some really exciting speakers that we are not going to announce until we get that website up, but we are super excited. Such a great combination of practical support for your business and networking, and just really great insight from industry leaders. And that is in Washington, D.C., September 18th through the 20th. So today, you will get to hear my conversation with Jerome Chang, architect and also founder of Blank Spaces, which is a co-working brand in the LA area. And Jerome is one of the OGs in the co-working world. He has been around for a long time, and he has a lot to share. And as I say in when we get started, I can't believe he has not been on the podcast yet. I know Jerome well, and we spend a lot of time together. And he's in LA, so he's fairly close to where I am, and we go to a lot of the same events. And yeah, so I'm super excited to have him share. He's going to talk about kind of his architecture principles and how he applies them to co-working and some of the lessons he's learned throughout the years. So without further ado, oh, I have to also mention, so I was poking around my iTunes to look for reviews to say thanks to, and it turns out that Jerome is the last one who left me a review at the beginning of April. And I did not realize that when I asked him to be on the show. But thank you, Jerome. Big high five for that review. And he basically said, I didn't pull it up to read it, I just remembered. Thank you for contributing great content that's great for new people, but also veterans like Jerome. And you will see he's definitely a veteran. Tons of great industry knowledge to share. So those reviews are super helpful. Thank you, Jerome, for taking the time to do that. Helps other people find the podcast and a resource that can help them start their own space. So grab a minute today, go to iTunes, write a review. All right, here we go. Welcome, everyone. I have a very special guest today, and I frankly cannot believe that I've been through 100 episodes of this podcast and he has not been on. So we may be about to make up for lost time and do a Jerome Chang series of episodes. So I have with me today Jerome Chang, who is architect and founder of Blank Spaces, which is a co-working brand in the LA area. Jerome, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me.
I am. So we had to decide which topic we were going to tackle first, because Jerome has been doing this for a very long time and has various topics of wisdom to share, or various wisdom on topics to share. So we're going to dive into Jerome's co-working story in a minute, but we're going to start with the fact that I've known Jerome. I was thinking this morning, I met you in October of 2012, and it's sort of easy to remember how long we've known each other, because so our kids, our oldest kids, Jerome's oldest kid, I only have one, they're like a week apart, and we met right before they turned one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it was at a Lexi meeting in New York, and I had not been open for a year, and I still felt like I had no idea what I was doing. And here's Jerome, who's been, when did you start your first space?
April 2008.
Right. So you've been doing this for more than 4 years at that point.
Yeah.
So Jerome's totally on it, and he's an architect, so he just is like deep into the business. But we became fast friends probably because we're both from the East Coast, kid the same age. And now we're like long lost cousins, except he's Asian and I'm not. We have the same, well, you now have the car that I want. We own the same shoes.
Yeah, the color of car I want. And we both have upstate New York roots.
Totally. Exactly. Jerome has a slightly better pedigree than I do when you look at the full equation, but... Well, we might dive into that. So Jerome, tell lots of people listening have probably talked to you, because Jerome's been doing this for so long. And I think he's lovely in being super generous with your time. You talk to a lot of people who are opening spaces, maybe a little bit less now, but back in the day, you were like the only one. And so I think you used to get all the phone calls. So a lot of people know who you are. But tell us about like your background and how you got into co-working in 2008.
Sure. I wanted to get out of my corporate gig. Technically, it was only about a 30-person firm, but I've been hopping around from architecture firm. And in 2005, I decided I really wanted to exit. And so in 2006, I finally, after procrastinating for a year, I opened my laptop and started my business plan. And just like my presentation at Juicy last week, it was literally about 10 minutes. I said, all right, I need to collect rent and to pay rent. And that was the beginning of my spreadsheet. About 6 months later, I produced about a 30-page business plan, sent it around to a few people I knew who owned businesses, were seen much wiser in business than I even pretended to know. And they circulated among some other people. I was able to raise half my funding target in about, I don't know, 3 months. And so I said, okay, I guess this is going to be real. So I quit my job, started looking for a space, and next 4 or 5 months, I raised the other half and opened, started construction end of 2007, and opened in early 2008, just in time to be able to pretend I got success. And then this 100-year recession came along and just crashed the party. So I think my other claim to fame is one of the very, very few co-working spaces still standing.
To be able
to say, I have confronted the worst recession that anyone has ever felt in 100 years and somehow able to get through that and then grow. So for all those who open after 2008, I wish you the best of luck. And it's very possible. Just be very creative.
Maybe a little off topic, but what do you think were your success factors for riding that out?
I mean, to this day, it's sheer persistence. Some people who I work with closely tell me I have more than 9 lives and I've gone through a lot of stuff, both strategically, financially. You know, I might have two children since then. I've opened a few locations. I've helped founded a couple of organizations such as Lexi. So like, I'm not one to say no, so I tend to just keep tackling more and more.
I'm curious, you were an early space, but did not go open plan. You've always had a mix of private spaces, team spaces, and open plan. Is that correct?
Yes, but you know, that's partly because, I mean, a lot driven because me as an architect who had previously designed a bunch of office spaces for other clients, never really saw it as open plan and private plan. It was always just a variety of workspaces.
Yeah.
And
it's
so
support the type of work different people need to do.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there's some dedicated spaces. There's some unreserved spaces, such as hot desking. There's private, there's open, there's closed, there's private, there's public. So for every you know, characteristic. There's the equal and opposite type of characteristic. Private, public, open, closed, you know, heads down, heads up, social, private, however you want to do it. And those are the kind of characteristics that you run through in describing the very strong intentional design efforts in your workspace.
Do you think that that combination helped you kind of weather the storm, the fact that you were not strictly open plan?
Well, it was good that it didn't require me to pivot as much, because when someone said, I want a quote unquote private office, I had that available to offer. But the rest of it really was just probably like any other entrepreneur, creative persistence.
Some sleepless nights, but figuring out how to make it work in the end.
God, there's so many days, especially in the beginning days of the recession, I'd wake up and say, oh my God, I need to find several thousand dollars or several hundred dollars to pay this bill or do this. And I really don't know how.
Do you think, given the popularity of co-working, that it's easier or harder to raise money today? I mean, you were a new operator. You were an architect, but that had nothing to do with running a co-working space, except that you knew, you know, you're probably in good shape to design one. And you glossed over your fundraising process. You made it sound somewhat simple. Do you think the environment is easier or harder today?
Oh, I think it's so much easier now. I mean, back then, the word co-working wasn't even really, you couldn't really use it. In fact, I didn't even use it on tours until probably 2012, 2013.
Wow.
So 4 years, I gave tours and sold memberships, opened a second location without really uttering the word co-working for the general public tours. Obviously, for those people who knew about it and for our messaging, we kept trying to educate the public. But, you know, when you have to go down to the lowest common denominator to convince people to join your space, you don't use the word co-working unless it was something familiar. So, you know, sales process, you just want to make it as simple as possible. And for some people, that's just a distraction, unfortunately, at least a term.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on a little bit more detail about your business. Tell us about your locations, where they are and who they serve, if it's different by location.
Yeah, sure. You know, LA is a very peculiar city in this country. In fact, I did my thesis in architecture school about suburbia, where suburbia is a unique type of American city where the city is made up all suburbs. There isn't a central business district or a centralized city as you would expect from a city like New York, Paris, all the big kind of cities.
Right. LA is the second largest city in the country, right?
Yeah, by square footage, by population, by capita, like who knows? But what we do know is that it's really an oversized suburb. And in fact, like the best way to describe it is the most evolved or the furthest developed suburbia of all the suburbia cities. And other suburban cities include Phoenix, Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, all the kind of middle American second tier cities. But LA happens to be a gateway top five city. And then we look at the physical topography, LA is made subdivided, self-segregated by major highways, which we all know about car traffic. It's not Highway 45, it's the 405, as if there's any other.
Right.
The 110, right. The 101.
We call it the 101 up here too. So,
okay. Yes.
Jerome recently bought an electric car, by the way.
Yes.
For the traffic, which I'm envious of.
So I can get on the toll roads and count as a carpool lane for free.
Totally.
So I just picked locations that were in each of the kind of highway segregated areas.
Okay.
And the way I kind of saw LA was a series of like these intense nodes, these pockets of vibrant neighborhoods, and they were separated by blank spaces in between. That's really how I came up with the word blank spaces.
No pun intended, right?
No, I mean, it was quite literally how I came up with the name. It was my architectural way of describing the city of LA in basically, you know, in two words. So my intention was to be able to use co-working spaces to activate communities in these blank spaces. I ultimately ended up focusing on being in an already established intense node because the space in between is, I think, that next frontier.
Got it. And so are the people you serve in each location? Wait, tell us where your locations are today.
Sure. So I'm going west to east in LA. I have downtown Santa Monica, 2nd and Broadway, which is basically one block from the ocean. Mm-hmm. I have downtown Culver City right at Main and Culver across the street from the City Hall. I have Larchmont, which is basically adjacent to Hollywood. And it's a very quaint neighborhood, about three block stretch, but you get the proximity of Hollywood. and then Playhouse District in Pasadena on the Colorado Boulevard, which everyone knows around the world as the strip where the Rose Parade goes along every New Year's Day. So it literally goes in front of our building. So if you're talking about vibrant, I mean, it's like an iconic pathway. I have a new location in Irvine, which is Orange County. We call it Behind the Curtain, Behind the Orange Curtain. And that's about a month old. And then I'm opening in downtown Long Beach this summer, which is at 3rd and Pine along the promenade. So 3rd and Pine would be 3 blocks from the waterfront. So all these are kind of these destination neighborhoods, because I believe that co-working spaces are really as office as destination. We're providing office spaces where you are paying to choose to go there, whereas if you're an employee, you are paid to go there.
Right. That's such an important thing. Totally. I know. Try to remind people that, right, no one's paying you. People are voting with their wallets. So where do people want to go? Totally.
Right.
Jerome, by the way, I love it when you said you were procrastinating about doing your business plan, because that's the last word I would ever associate with anything that you do. You always have a project. I mean, a lot of these locations are fairly new. And I know you've been doing this for a while, but you're also an active architect. And every time I send Jerome an email, he answers it like immediately. I am terrible at email. And Jerome, I feel like Jerome has like zero inbox. He's all over everything and he gets work done. It amazes me. Maybe we'll do an episode on productivity. And you have two kids and a dog and you're the dog walker and the dinner maker and you have a lot going on. But anyway, okay, so one of the unique things, there's a lot of unique things about Jerome, but you are an architect and you overlay that onto this business model of co-working. And Jerome and I were talking about that last week. There's so few people who do that. And I worry about folks starting spaces sort of getting in the wrong hands, the wrong designer hands, who just, they don't understand the business model. It's so unique. We're looking for a return on our real estate. It is not just a cost of doing business. And we're trying to optimize the revenue we can make out of the space, plus make it an amazing experience. It's not a simple task that we're trying to accomplish. So can you talk about the things that you do in your business that are kind of unique to your perspective as an architect and an operator?
Sure. You know, in my opinion, the architecture is so integrated into the business model. I actually quite surprised and impressed with other people who try to tackle this without having such training or background in architecture, or let alone any building industry trade. Whether you're formerly an electrician, electrical engineer, construction guy, real estate guy, there's just something that, you know, this brick and mortar aspect of the co-working space, it's your number one cost to open. It's your number one cost, at least through rent or mortgage payments, as a recurring operating expense. And yet, if this is not your number one specialty, you know, it's like being a makeup artist deciding to do facial reconstructive surgery. Like, you know, you're just out of your depth, and I'm sure you can learn it, but you know, good luck on that crash course. So because I've been doing this for a while now, like there's a level of like almost down to a craft, I think, how I see and implement the architecture, the design of a co-working space, both functionally for the performa and then for the user experience, so that it actually does really make sense, which does mean that I have to make a lot of trade-offs and say that's not worth it. There's no return. It's not worth the effort. Maybe we can do that later. But it kind of centralizes down to what really needs to happen. And like simple things like I often won't fully furnish my space on day one. I'll do about 75%, because this way, if the feedback on the furniture I did buy is not good, the last 25% can be better. Or maybe misjudge what was needed, and therefore, or maybe I don't ramp up that as much as I need to. And so I'll just hold off on that last 25%.
And in terms of kind of like thinking about what are some of the, without giving away all your secret sauce, but some of the user experience components that you integrate into your space based on kind of your architect brain and the model?
Yeah, one of the simplest and most common factors to consider is your power outlets. Everyone has multiple devices, which means that the standard way of just adding what you call a duplex outlet, that's the, you know, the pair of two outlets that you put on the wall, is just woefully underpowered. So I always put a quadplex, which is four outlets per, you know, location. It doubles your number of outlets and avoids unnecessary power strips and all that, because you're ultimately going to use the power strips anyways. So that's a simple way to, with a nominal cost, be able to make that space much more functional for your better user experience.
And then I have to bring this one up because you responded to a comment in the Everything Coworking Facebook group about what size should my offices be? And you said, well, work backwards from what size should your desktops be and then design the office out. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, the standard process for all designers, whether you're an architect, interior designer, or any other type of designer, is that you fit out the space based on the spatial requirements from your clients, get it down to like, oh, the senior manager has 150 square feet, the junior manager has 140 square feet, make sure those hierarchies all set, blah, 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 blah. And I threw that out the window and said, well, what does that mean if I can't fit two desks or four desks? And so what I'll do is I will sketch out the floor plan based on what I need for my pro forma and the space and all that. And then much early on is that then I pick my furniture, price it, input them in, and then massage the spaces so that they fit in increments of the desk size in at least two configurations. So it can allow, you know, for different flexibility. And unfortunately, most designers are so pre-programmed to fit out the space and say, okay, we sign off on this. Then they go out and buy the specify the furniture, and they don't really think about, whoops, if I had just 2 more inches here.
Right. Sometimes that's all it is, right? It's like, yeah.
And then they're like, oh. Desk,
which is a whole other $450 or, you know, whatever it is a month.
And then the furniture people are like, oh, no problem. We can customize it. Like, I don't want to spend more money to customize something I've already lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. 2 inches, 6 inches, whatever it is. But you take your, let's say, 4 inches and do it across 10 offices, that's 40 inches. That was almost a whole nother desk.
Yep. Right. Exactly. And the revenue that can generate, which I think is like, I mean, that's the unique piece that, to your point, you could find a good corporate designer who's done, you know, hip startup spaces and whatnot, but they just still will never know those nuances. They won't know how to think about making those trade-offs to monetize the space without, I mean, the desk size, you're specifying the desk size based on what the person does. I think in the post you were like, look, they might need 2 monitors. You decide what desk that is. And do they need to put a pet underneath it? So you're not trying to go with the smallest desktop possible, but you're thinking about your end user and sort of what makes sense for them. And then how many can I fit in a room?
Yeah. But then even operationally, do I really want more than like 2 different desks? It's confused the operations and front desk staff about what goes where. You know, often you'll find that the desk you put in this office will be relocated to another office or out somewhere else. So you really just want to stick to, you know, just maybe a couple of desk types so that they're all interchangeable. So, which does cause a compromise, but you're simplifying your operations down the road. And unfortunately, a lot of designers, architects, they never see the full cycle, not design cycle, but the full life cycle of that space and that equipment that you've just bought. They don't have an intuition of what to even anticipate.
Yeah. Like in real life, how does this play out? And you know that exactly, which is right. I mean, you sort of brought this up at the beginning, the discipline required, because you can see all the possibilities and yet you have to draw the lines and make those trade-offs. Yeah. We should have done this first, but for anybody who's listening who has not done their space yet, can you talk about kind of the role of an architect? I mean, you were saying like, oh gosh, I can't even imagine the people who get into this and have no background in, you know, real estate or design or anything. And lots of people do. And so they need to rely on experts, you know, and you're one of those who would help kind of handhold people through the process. So what does it look like when you hire an architect and or a designer to help you work on your co-working space?
Well, any of you who've ever hired an architect will likely have learned that they can be very useful right in the beginning of even choosing the space itself to help you visualize what's possible, note stuff that are challenges, and just discuss those things. And whether or not you have to pay that architect or designer for the consult is up to you and that person, but just even strategically, that's going
like
to be you.
Like serving as an advisor. Yeah.
Or you should really do that right off the bat. And then there's the next step, which often I get asked to do, which is a kind of a feasibility plan, do a test fit. And because I can do the performance, I can do that as well. But whoever does your performance can match up with the space plan and then do some forecasting and budgeting and such. So there's a financial aspect that helps flesh out some initial reality. Then the architect can be involved in the rest of it. Once she decides feasible, then go ahead and do a real design process. And this is really where, you know, probably 85% of all architects are definitely involved in, which is the design cycle. But you notice that there's at least two steps before that, before you even enter the arena. And then there's the architect potentially checking in after you move in, maybe a month in, 6 months in, 12 months in. Almost positive, literally like not even 1% of architects checking on the space a year later, a year later. It's like, how did they end up using the space?
Yeah.
Did they actually buy what you told them to buy? And if they didn't, why didn't they? And what were the alternatives? Is it a budget thing, space thing, or whoops, I forgot that should be 2 inches over? It could be down to that. It's incredible, the small but ridiculously critical mistakes that are made.
So talk a little bit about the variations of roles, like architects, designers, you know, who does what? Can one person perform all those functions?
Yeah. So, you know, there's the way I often compare it to is licensed architects are like general surgeons. They technically could do almost anything. They have the license to do that, and they have the training to do that. Whether or not they should be doing it, it depends on their specialty. You know, do you want a general surgeon to do cardiothoracic, whatever? That's maybe not. And so then interior designers are like dermatologists. They can crack through the surface and give out medication and stuff. But I don't know if they can do reconstructive surgery. So they can do maybe parts of it. And then interior decorating, sort of like, I don't know, makeup maybe. It's very surface level, but it can be very transformative. If your scope is just to like, you know, I just want to have great hair, lighting, and makeup for the day, great, boom. But maybe you have to deal with serious safety hazards with it related to the space, with code of compliance and all that, and you just have to pick your designers accordingly. Sometimes, and oftentimes you'll hire maybe all three because you want to specialize it. The licensed architect to do the bones of it, interior designer to really, you know, polish it off, an interior decorator to style it in a way that's more sales oriented or really has an emotional connection to the user. Could a licensed architect do some of that? Sure, but it just depends on their focus. There's a lot to cover, you know.
You need a licensed architect to do plans if you are submitting to do construction and get permits to do that construction, correct?
For the most part, interior designers can do quite a bit.
Yeah.
It depends on what you have to do to the space. So I think, you know, as a licensed architect, I have carte blanche to do basically anything. So like I can, you know, turn the space upside down if I want to. But I think the interior designer know better. But from what I understand is that their delineation stops at structural walls, structural components. Okay. So they can move walls and stuff, but if they're a structural wall, they require structural engineering, then they need to hire the structural engineer and the architect to design and draw that part of it, which then means that they're, you know, the architectural engineer will put their stamp on the drawing. But if it's purely an interior designer, they have to, they stop up to non-rated walls, non-rated partitions.
Yeah, Jerome, I can see why this might be overwhelming for someone.
Just, I mean, how many people know even know what a partition is, right? It's an architectural lingo, but that's what we use. It's what separates between one side and another, and what you're trying to separate. Maybe you have an explosive chemical on one side and you have people sleeping on the other side. That determines what kind of wall construction you have.
So this is diving in a little bit, but if you were advising, playing sort of that advisory role that you suggested an architect play when you're at the point of even just considering space, like what are kind of the big mistakes you see people make in going after a space, or what would you advise them to look at? Like, I'm trying to remember what the term is. I was just talking to Casey Godwin about this. Like when there's a lot of like non-revenue generating space that you're paying for, what's that called? Common area factor?
Yeah, right. Bathrooms, lobbies, hallways.
Yeah.
You know, technically, conference room to extent if you don't charge for them, which
right.
I don't, you know, I would heavily discourage from. You should definitely charge for them. You know, my favorite and obviously the most controversial topic, if I say they're not good, which is our, you know, phone booths. I think phone booths are basically undersized meeting rooms. If you made them bigger, you'd get a lot more bang out of your buck on that. But yeah, so I basically avoid hallways. Alvar Aalto did this whole thing. He's like this famous architect from the middle of last century. And he used to design apartments itself with almost no hallways. It's sort of the kind of like the holy grail of designing spaces, because hallways have almost no point. except to go conduit from point A to point B. But if you can really maximize your space in order to maximize user experience, hallways are rarely part of that equation.
Yeah. Any other like sort of red flags for you, like weird shaped spaces or I don't know what else?
Yeah. You know, I've really avoided angles and curves mm-hmm. in my floor plans because at the end of the day, it's, you know, you want to allow or accommodate different configurations and boxes basically do it. And does it basically come down to a collection of beautiful boxes? Yes, but you can go a long way with that. Do you want to create this like interesting, you know, angled or a curvy space? Sure, but you're just going to be less efficient. And at the end of the day, you are trying to maximize the revenue out of your brick and mortar operation.
Yeah. And so, and what are a couple of, besides the don't do phone booths, do small meeting rooms, what are a couple of other your favorite kind of design must do's, like carpet tiles in meeting rooms?
Oh, right. That's a common mistake. You know, these concrete floors all look so beautiful, but they do nothing for you for acoustics. In fact, they make your life hell.
Right.
So you have to really add a variety of material types. And oftentimes it's soft and some hard. Glass being hard, drywall being mostly hard, wood being surprisingly soft for it being a, you know, hard surface. Mm-hmm. Carpet tiles, even the leather or the fabric on your furniture is going to help. Ceiling tile, God, so important. What basic thing to remember is that acoustics come in basically two flavors. There's others, of course, but these are the two ones you have to really worry about is sound that goes through the surface, through a wall, and the sound that bounces around in your space. The ceiling tiles do nothing to stop the sound from going through. They're like styrofoam, okay? But they help shape the sound so that when you speak and then it bounces off the ceiling, it will eventually dissipate properly. So it doesn't seem like an echo chamber if it were a hard drywall ceiling. And that's such a big mistake to have drywall ceilings without ceiling tiles. It's the number one way to improve the reverberation, which is the bouncing of sound, and remove the echo chamber effect that you often find in, let's say, you know, spaces that are just glass and concrete and drywall. But then the soundproofing, which is the wall, the sound that goes through it, whether or not you actually have to make it 100% soundproof or somewhat soundproof is up to you. I actually like sound leaks because it ensures that you're not in an isolation chamber. You're not locked up in a jail cell voluntarily, that you actually hear some sound outside. So you are what I like to call awareness.
Yeah.
Even if you're by yourself in the office, you should be aware of what's going on around you. And that means that you have some smittering of sound around you from outside.
But you do not want to hear the conversation of the person in the office next to you.
Right. So yeah, you have to study that. And I've had some mixed success on that because sometimes the quality of the construction, unfortunately, just has enough fail to cause the leakage. So we have to compensate later.
And
yeah,
you,
it's really hard.
Right. We've talked about this because you use a fair amount of glass, not dividing walls, but storefront glass, like the front of your offices, and
right.
glass will leak and you can't really get around that. So you, what are some of the things you do to help with the leakage?
You know, sound is like water. It's persistent and pervasive. And you find a crack in that wall, crack in that door, and sound will go through it. So you have to just look at all the cracks and holes, all the potential leaks, and, you know, how much of a hermetic seal you want to create is up to you. But it's down to those, like, oh, that crack under the door, maybe that shouldn't be, you know, a half inch. It should be down to an eighth of an inch where you have some kind of brush gasketing to eliminate that leak. And sometimes it's really some small things to close up those holes.
So as an architect, do you look more at the small solutions? Like the gap under the door is a great example. We just put a new door in on the offices that we built, and I think that gap is like 3 inches. What? Right, because you have to think ahead about all those details, and I need to get one of those little flap things. But when you're thinking about trade-offs, like, you know, building the partition walls, you know, to the deck and like some of the, you know, spray insulation and some of the construction things you can do that obviously start to amp up expenses. How do you look at those trade-offs kind of overlaying our business model? Our business model is already really interesting in that, you know, it can take years just to pay off the build out. You know, I'm always talking to people about the length of their leases and trying to make the point that like, look, if you're going to do a nicer space, it's going to take you years to pay this back. I mean, depending, right? There are a lot of caveats and management agreements and things that you can do to kind of get around that. But construction costs matter and you have to kind of make some trade-offs here and there. How do you think about sort of doing some of those extra things, and when does it really matter?
It's up to the budget. Your budget will dictate so many things, and you will have to prioritize accordingly. You know, I've been in the architecture offices, and when you hear your principal or even a client say, we need to do this / this, and, you know, all the architects just groan and say, here's another budget cut, blah, blah, blah. And like, they don't understand us creative people. You got to do this, blah, blah, blah. But you've never sat at the other side where you have to pay the bill. And I mean, one of the things I'm starting to tell others is that architects, I think you have to negotiate a lease just one time to understand kind of some of the basic finances that go through in funding your very existence and design the space. So it's all budget driven, really. If you have an aluminum storefront glass and you just can't find any other way to justify it, maybe use a wood frame door with a glass inset. That's going to be a lot cheaper. And you have to just justify that, oh, that's my trade-off in aesthetics. I'm doing that right now in Long Beach.
Oh, interesting. Good to know.
Yeah.
Well, and budgets, but this is the interesting thing. The budget is not just like, I don't know, what does the real estate department, what are they willing to spend on this, right? It's, well, if I do that, then how many extra months does it take me to pay for that, right? Like, I think that's the really unique thing about our business model is it's not like a somewhat arbitrary budget. Like, it's real depending on your ROI on the project. And do you have investors, and have you promised them a certain, you know, rate of return? And so do you need to, but it also depends on who you serve, right? You can't, I mean, there's just always this fine balance of you can't keep cutting back your build out costs and end up with a space that doesn't attract members.
That's right. And so you kind of have to know your potential users, target audience, and just kind of know your operations, because that could, you know, bleed out costs that you could avoid. God, it's all those things. And you have to just balance it all. The simpler way to look at it is that this is the rare office space where you have to generate revenue from the office space itself. It's actual brick and mortar physicality square footage. No different than a hotel or an apartment complex.
Right.
But because everyone thinks of office space as a workplace for employees,
right,
the revenue generator there is from whatever billable hours that the employees make or products that they sell. But for us, our actual revenue comes straight from the space. So if you just remember that every square foot that you lose or you gain is a direct hit to your own bottom line versus an indirect hit to your bottom line for worker productivity.
Right.
You know, like, who says that if I give Joe a cubicle that's 50 square feet versus 60 square feet, and that's going to translate to indirectly a 15% improvement to his productivity, assuming he's always working productively.
Right.
That's indirect. But for you, that's literally like, that's it. You know, that if you had saved 10% for 10 cubicles or work desks or whatever it is, that's another desk, which is a direct increase in revenue.
Exactly. Right. So different. So, okay, my last couple of questions for you. For somebody starting, kind of what one sort of piece of design advice you would give them, like right from the start, aside from get an architect as an advisor on your team?
Related to the design?
Yeah, or layout, or some Jerome tip to share.
Yeah, I guess someone with experience in this specific space. There's really, I think, at least known to me, are really a handful of us who've done multiple spaces. It's become a sub specialty. The ones that just crank out office designs for XYZ companies, they're not it.
I mean, mostly because of the point you just made. Like, we're a hotel model versus make our people as productive and happy as possible. Spare no expense.
Yeah, I mean, it's random stuff. Like, when I was working on a hotel way back in my early years, you know, like when you go down a hotel hallway and there's that bump out. The bump out has two doors and then two rooms, and then there's a little gap in between. That dimension between the doors and that depth of that bump out is dictated by the cleaning cart.
Oh, right.
So that when you put the cart there, it doesn't intrude into the hallway if it's done properly.
Yep.
Industrial warehouses now are trying to go vertical, and they're trying to be closer to that last mile of delivery. But they're choking on, in the U.S., on the size of the typical 18-wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
And so their loading dock and all this is dictated by the truck size.
Yep.
Meanwhile, other countries who have already moved away from 18-wheelers, either because they never had or what, have like what they call box trucks or vans. And so they can have a lot more options in newer types of warehousing because they're not dictated by this 18-wheeler that can only make a circle radius turn of whatever. A lot of Class A buildings that you see, those columns seem totally irrational. Like, oh, that's ugly there where it should be here or whatever. But if you just bring down that column all the way down to the parking lot, the column locations are dictated by the parking spaces in that garage downstairs. If the parking layout consultant says, if you do this, I can get another space out of there, the real estate developer is like, well, move that column.
Right.
And the engineer's like, no. And the architect's like, oh my God, you just messed me up. Yes. And you just look at the parking space underneath. So sometimes it's driven by these things that you can't touch where no one else wants to touch. The trucks for warehouses, parking spaces for Class A buildings.
Cleaning cart location.
For the hotels.
You know, my hotel in Denver, the cleaning people with their carts were taking up the entire hallway. And I wonder if they took out that bump.
It's possible.
I thought it was, I mean, in my hospitality hat, I was like, oh my gosh, this should never happen. There should never be cleaning carts. And I literally cannot get through. We won't even get into hotel bathroom design and who does that. Not anybody who uses the bathroom to do their hair in the morning, that's for sure. Okay, well, we're going to do another episode on Jerome's wisdom around operations and how that's evolved over the years. Because Jerome, you go to your locations, you try to make the lap every week, right?
That's right. Right now I have 5 operating locations. There's 5 days of the week. So every week I just hit them all. One per day. Every week is slightly different depending on, you know, big tours, needs and such. Because as an architect, I'm pretty plugged into specific facility maintenance and repairs, even down to like we were picking garbage cans for Culver City. And I got involved in that because we're replacing pretty ugly ones with nice shiny ones and had to kind of fall in line with our design review board consisting of one person.
Got it. Would almost, it might be better for you if those locations weren't drivable.
So 3 of them are along the metro line in LA, which most people don't even know exist. And then the other 2 are a little off the beaten path, but it's, you know, this is another topic, but I've accumulate locations in this last couple of years through management agreements. So it wasn't always my choice on the exact location. It was more like, hey,
follow
Jerome.
Follow the deal.
Yeah, follow the deal. Jerome, help us activate these. Okay.
Yeah, we're going to hit Jerome up for that topic as well. So Jerome's just super engaged in operations and he's had a lot of hiring lessons learned over the years and managing employees and building up his team to support these locations. So we're going to cover that and his experience with management agreements in a future episode. So we will wrap up for today. Jerome, thank you so much for your time and for giving us a little insight into the world of a co-working space owner and architect.
You're welcome and thank you for inviting me.
Jerome, if someone wants to find you and learn more about you, what's the best way?
I'm on Twitter, Jerome USA, JeromeUSA, and just my email, jerome@blankspaces.com.
Perfect. Awesome. Until next time.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.